This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's time for our weekly news review. Cincinnati Public Schools changed its plans for students to return to in-person learning. WVXU reporter Corey Sharber, he's with us now on the phone about the decision and what's next for students in this region's largest school district. Corey, thanks for being with us.
No problem, Michael. Thanks for having me.
So, Corey, last time we talked, we were outlining the plan for returning to school, and now it appears those plans have changed again. What happened?
Well, as you, I guess, I don't know if you're totally aware of this, this is currently a worldwide pandemic going on. Hamilton County recently just went up to right back up to level 3 status as far as COVID-19 is concerned. And because of that, CPS has decided to remain in distance learning. And it wasn't that long ago. In fact, it was, I believe, earlier this week. They had finalized the plans to return next week. And now everything is kind of, well, it's not necessarily back to square one because still the plan is, they still have a plan set up, but everything is just going to go back to distance learning.
So what is the superintendent, Laura Mitchell, saying about this? Because I know that she reacted to these growing numbers in Hamilton County.
Well, she said, of course, you know, she's the school board is, you know, disappointed to have made the decision, but they believe it's the right choice to continue with distance learning. Like she said that, you know, with 36,000 students and 6,000 staff members, this is the safest option in order to keep everybody, you know, away from the virus during this time.
I thought it was interesting, Corey, that it appears families that have students in the Cincinnati public school system are apparently split according to a new survey about their comfort level on returning to the classroom. What can you tell us about that?
That's right. In the last regular meeting earlier this week on Monday, they revealed that they were conducting a survey. Over 3,000 parents took part in that. And like you said, 49% of parents expressed a level of comfort in sending their kids back to school for in-person learning. However, 48% were either hesitant or extremely uncomfortable with that.
So it looks like almost a literal split down the middle, with 49% expressing a certain level of comfort with going back, and about that same number expressing hesitation or extreme discomfort. So it looks like there is no clear consensus. So a very challenging period to be leading this large urban school district in a county that's seeing another spike in COVID-19 cases. You reported previously, Corey, about the financial impact on the district that COVID-19 has had. Remind us.
Well, so far, COVID-19 has cost the school district more than $42 million. Now, $2.2 million has gone towards expanding the staff at the Cincinnati Digital Academy in order to help with remote learning during this time. But they've also spent at least $4 million to hire more nurses throughout the school district, and $5.3 million has gone towards cleaning supplies, PPE, and thermometers. But, of course, all that money right now, it's still, there's still a lot of uncertainty with the future of everything. I mean, there's still so many costs that you just can't calculate at this time. Like, if they have to do any more school closures, could that either help the school district save money or cost them more in the long run? It's still a lot to be determined.
We're talking with WVXU reporter Corey Sharber. Okay, so this is a decision now to remain in distant learning status for Cincinnati Public Schools students. There is a board meeting coming up. Do we expect them to take up this issue?
That's probably going to be at the main discussion. At the next board meeting, the CPS board expects to discuss the current health situation with COVID-19 in Hamilton County and in the city of Cincinnati. And they're going to be looking at longer-term recommendations as well as the future of athletics in the school district.
Okay, did we hear from school board members at all about this most recent decision? I know that there were a lot of conversations in the most recent weeks about what the best path forward might be before they ultimately decided on the plan to return kids to school in some capacity. What are we hearing from them now, if anything?
I haven't really gotten into too much as far as what the other school board members are saying. I will say that, for the most part, everybody has been on board with going back to in-person learning. The only opponent really on the school board to this has been Mike Morosky, and it seems like he's kind of aligning with, like we mentioned earlier, where 48% of parents are, you know, uncomfortable with sending their kids back to school. He's kind of been the voice for that for that basis of the parents sending their kids to school. So right now, I think we'll just get more. We could see a change of opinion at this next board meeting, but that's still to be determined.
Again, we're talking with WVXU reporter Corey Sharber. And Corey, you also covered a story this week that came as a shock to a lot of people in northern Kentucky. The Kentucky Speedway won't wave the checkered flag for a NASCAR race next season as the sport's biggest name took Sparta off the calendar. But officials in Gallatin and nearby counties won't wave the white flag either. Corey, we're going to bring in for this part of the conversation WKRC reporter Alexa Helwig. She joins us now via Zoom. Alexa, welcome back to our show.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Michael. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you back on. My goodness, this was quite a shock to a lot of people. Kentucky Speedway had become quite accustomed to hosting some pretty big races. So what is the community, both business and tourism, what are their reactions to this devastating news that NASCAR has cut Kentucky Speedway from its 2021 schedule?
Yeah, so people all over the region in greater Cincinnati, northern Kentucky, they say this is a huge loss. Just in 2020, the Speedway celebrated its 10th anniversary hosting the Quaker State 400. So when NASCAR had been at the Kentucky Speedway for the last 10 years, so all of a sudden to just get cut really is going to make an impact on race car fans, and then also the economy. I talked with Brent Cooper. He is the president of the Northern Kentucky Chamber of Commerce, and he just says it's going to hit the economy hard. It could lose millions of dollars. Local restaurants, bars, and hotels, they all benefit from this racing series that usually comes through in July. So yeah, they're saying it's a big loss, and it's really upsetting for not just fans, but for also local officials and local leaders who lean on this event to bring in people to the community and bring in money to the local economy.
And so we're talking about the potential loss of dozens of jobs in addition to millions of dollars in broader revenue to that area. We heard from the Northern Kentucky Convention and Visitors Bureau, known as Meet NKY. They expressed extreme concern about this loss. Alexa, what is to become of the Speedway? What have we heard from Speedway officials about how they might pivot?
So right now, the general manager, Mike Simmendinger, he released a statement on Tuesday saying that they're going to transition or try to transition into a multi-use complex or facility. So they are hoping to hold music festivals, special events, different racing series to try and just bring more people out to the Speedway. So they've held some music, some concerts or music festivals in the past, and some of them have done well, others not so much. They held Metallica back in 2000, and then in 2006, we reported that they had a country concert, but it ultimately had to cancel it because it didn't sell enough tickets. So people are saying that Mark Simmendinger, he is a smart businessman, and everyone that's involved with the Kentucky Speedway, they will make good decisions, and they will hopefully come out on top with this transition into a new multi-use kind of complex for that small city of Sparta.
That's WKRC Local 12 reporter Alexa Helwig, who joins us via Zoom. We're also on the phone with WVXU reporter Corey Sharber. And Corey, you talked to the judge executive of Owen County, and he expressed a little bit of optimism, Casey Ellis did.
That's right. Like, as our guest mentioned earlier, they're planning to convert Kentucky Speedway into a multi-use facility. Now, while, of course, don't get me wrong, like, KCLSD Owen County Judge Executive, of course, he expressed many of the same opinions everyone else has, with the disappointment that they're not having a race. But he said that the loss of a NASCAR race could actually be a plus for the area if they get that multi-use facility on the right track, because let's say they get it on the right track and they can have more events besides NASCAR races, they could have a more consistent schedule of events at the facility.
And this extends beyond the Northern Kentucky and the exurban Northern Kentucky area like Owen and Gallatin counties. We heard from Governor Andy Beshear as it relates to this topic. He said he had been working with NASCAR to see the Commonwealth be one of the first locations to race after these COVID-19 restrictions were lifted at some point in the future. I mean, what else did the governor have to say, Corey?
Pretty pretty much echoing the same concerns that Northern Kentucky had. He's very disappointed that they couldn't get anything scheduled, but he's hoping that this will only be a short-term thing. He's hoping NASCAR officials will reconsider this to make this change for only this year, perhaps even less. So the future of NASCAR races in Kentucky is uncertain, but there is still a level of optimism that they will return to this, to the Bluegrass State.
I think it's clear that's going to be an ongoing story. I mean, we saw just in the past year a lot of money coming in from the federal government to help build an airport in that area. And although that's more designed for the business community, I guess, along the corridor between Cincinnati and Louisville, I think that the Speedway had been looked at as a target to benefit from that as well. So we'll continue to follow that. I want to thank WVXU reporter Corey Sharber for being with us today. We'll talk again soon, Corey.
See you later. Thanks for having me.
Let's continue now with WKRC-TV Local 12 reporter Alexa Helwig. Alexa, you know, you're in a newsroom, I'm in a newsroom. I think it's not uncommon that we get complaints from candidates and supporters of those candidates about who's stealing whose signs and the wrong, illegal places where signs are placed. But my goodness, in one part of town, you're talking about some serious vandalism involving yard signs.
Yeah, so I did a story this week, and these vandals took it to the next level. I went over to Amberley Village, and some of the neighbors there tell me that their Biden and Harris signs and also their Black Lives Matter signs were burnt straight to the ground. So I went over to the neighborhood, and one of the ladies even left the framework up of her original sign, and it showed that it was just, I mean, completely burnt. And then also the ground was scorched, the grass was scorched. So yeah, these vandals, it's obviously a contentious race we have coming up next month, and it's happening. It's not just happening, like you said, in Amberley Village. It's happening all over the region and all over the country, and it's happening on both sides of the parties. We even did a story earlier in September where somebody in Miami Township stole some Trump signs and tossed them in a dumpster. So again, yeah, it's happening, kind of happening all over. But yeah, in this case, kind of those vandals, they took it to another level, using fire and setting these signs on fire. And obviously that was upsetting and kind of scary for the neighbors in Amberley Village, because I mean, the fire could have spread to their houses, because it, they're telling us that it happened overnight. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting time.
Yeah. Alexa, you note that this, at least in Amberley Village, happened in the same neighborhood, multiple signs burned with different messages or campaigns being supported by those signs. With it all happening in one generalized area in Amberley Village, what are neighbors there saying about any concerns they might have about their safety?
They are very concerned. The one woman that I interviewed, she says, I don't have surveillance video right now, but by the end of this week, I will have cameras up on my house. I will keep my lights on overnight, so if I can see, or if somebody is walking by and they feel like doing this again to those signs, that maybe that would push them away, because there are lights on and somebody could potentially see them from other surveillance video. Because in this case, I talked to Amberley Village Police Department and they did not have any surveillance video or recordings of when it happened. So they are worried, and they say this is a small, very quiet, quaint neighborhood. Never would have expected this to happen. So they are going to kind of up their security after this all happened.
Did police in Amberley Village indicate that this was an active investigation, though, that maybe they were going to keep an eye out for this sort of activity taking place in the nighttime hours?
Yeah, they definitely will keep an eye on it. Definitely. They, like I said, they didn't have any surveillance video of when it happened, but they are going to keep an eye out for this, because this is not something that they want to happen again. And nearby, and the next neighborhood over, Deer Park, they have also had one report or a couple reports of signs getting burnt, and they even posted on Facebook saying, this is criminal activity. So we are warning you, if you burn, if you destroy or vandalize political yard signs, that's a criminal act. So they are putting out that warning in that next neighborhood over as well. So I think everybody's going to be on the lookout for if this happens again.
4.5 weeks until Election Day. We'll see if it happens again. Alexa Helwig is a reporter with WKRC-TV Local 12. Alexa, thanks so much for spending part of your Friday with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a good weekend.
You too. And up next, how the legacy of the founders of the University of Cincinnati and Xavier University are being reevaluated in this national reckoning on racial justice. And later, what experts are saying about kids and trick-or-treating during the COVID-19 pandemic. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Some local activists and community members are looking to move Cincinnati's collaborative agreement forward 2 years after that police and community relationship document was last refreshed. WVXU reporter and midday host Ann Thompson joins us now in a socially distanced studio. Ann, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Our pleasure. So 18 years ago, the Cincinnati Collaborative Agreement was signed, and 2 years ago, it was refreshed. And this involves the city, members of the community, and the Department of Justice related to policing in this community. Now there are even more recommendations in the wake of everything that's going on. What can you tell us about the new developments?
Right. So there are about 150 recommendations, you know, now that the climate has changed after we've had various protests. Organizations such as Leaders of the Free World here locally got people together and organized all their ideas and came up with about 150 recommendations of ways that policing could improve. One of their ideas was taking police officers out of the schools. Some people see officers there and that kind of as a pipeline from schools to prison, and they think there are better ways getting the kids help that they could. Now, the reason it came up this week is because during Council's Law and Public Safety Committee, the chairman, Christopher Smitherman, is kind of committed to getting these ideas out there. And they hadn't really done this for a while because of COVID. They hadn't heard from what the city was up to through the city manager's office, Jason Cooper, who had some ideas that some of the parties claimed, like, hey, wait, why are you moving ahead with some of this? And we didn't even know about it. But then it came out that Jason Cooper had been furloughed for a while. So now they just want to get everybody on the same page. The city had some things it was working on, including putting some of the cases that were closed up on this open data portal. Also, pedestrian stops, putting that up on the open portal and introducing new tasers and body cameras, things like that.
Is there any indication about when a more formal refresh, something that we might note as these parties came to the table and agreed to something and now this document is officially updated, any sense of a timeline?
Well, in short, no, not really. Smitherman committed to having more of these meetings, and he realizes it's very important whatever they come up with, because he says, you know, whatever changes are ultimately made, we'll only know if they'll work when a critical incident comes up that's diffused by police. He says, we're not tested here in the room and when we're all singing Kumbaya. It's when we have the citizen who's in the park, he has a knife and is charging an officer.
Well, we know that story will continue and we will continue to cover it. And in our previous segment, we had Alexa Helwig on from WKRC-TV talking about some burning of campaign signs out in the community. So we know how contentious of an election season we're dealing with. But we also have the President of the United States who has called into question the very integrity of the election. And it appears that local FBI agents are taking this very seriously as well.
Yes. So the FBI has been involved in election security since the 1970s. And then in 2016, they added a cyber component to monitor election fraud. For this election, nationally, they've been holding command post exercises over the summer. And here locally, a special agent and an intelligence analyst have been preparing to focus on federal election crimes. Today, in fact, this afternoon at 1:30, there's a very important meeting. And it seems that nobody in the FBI here has remembered any kind of a meeting taking place like this, where they get together state officials, the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office. They're meeting in Columbus, and they're just kind of educating people on the, what would be federal crimes, like voter intimidation, ballot stuffing, things like that.
And this is something that they can't really remember ever having to deal with before,
that's
at least
right,
in terms
with
of practice.
Everything that's surrounding this particular election. And of course, you mentioned the president's claims and things like that. The special agent in charge, Chris Hoffman, emphasized that the state people, you know, are dealing with state laws and he's dealing with federal crimes, but just wanted to get everybody together so they're kind of on the same page. And the special agent in charge will be in Columbus. He kind of oversees Cincinnati, Columbus, Dayton, and some other cities, but he'll be in Columbus on election night just to be close to the Secretary of State's office.
We'll look forward to what comes out of that meeting. I'm sure that we'll have an update as the election nears. We are just about 4.5 weeks away. The local FBI and other state officials and criminal officials will be meeting this afternoon, so we'll look forward to an update. And you had a great story this week out of Indiana, Richmond, Indiana, where there's a beautiful historic district. And one guy there is taking it upon himself with some friends and some colleagues.
And he's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's not often you come across somebody like this. So first of all, let's just say he's a scientist, not just any scientist. He just published a paper in the journal Nature. He's a musician, but again, not any musician. At one point, he was accepted into an Italian opera program. He's also an outdoorsman who leads wilderness excursions in Utah. So
I know I was reading this and I started to dislike him, frankly, during it. It was like, can you leave some for the rest of us with all those talents?
And it's like, how did you get involved in this? Well, he's interested. So he's become the executive director of Richmond Neighborhood Restoration. He's kind of hanging out there in Indiana. He's a 2017 graduate of Earlham College. And they got him to do this. And he's just putting all of his effort into it. Richmond just has a rich history. And in fact, there's a stretch known along Main Street as Millionaire's Row. During the organization's time, they fixed up 5 homes in 5 years. The homes have some rich history. One was built by a farmer in the 1870s, possibly one of the first homes there. Another home was owned by a female hat maker. And that was just unusual to have a home owned by a woman. So, and then I think he made the claim, and I know it's been made by a lot of small cities, like, hey, we had more millionaires per capita at the turn of the century than any other place. He said, yeah, you might want to fact check that. But regardless, they have a lot of homes, and so this group will certainly be keeping busy.
Worth paying a socially distanced visit to Richmond to check out these houses.
Definitely.
If you can't make it to Richmond, though, in the meantime, you can check out some photos that Ann included in the story and listen to the rest of the story and meet this very talented 2017 Earlham College graduate, Eric Nicholson, and learn more about him and these projects that are going on at WVXU.org. Ann Thompson, so nice to see you. Thanks for spending some time with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Michael.
The founders of the University of Cincinnati and Xavier University were each involved in the slave trade during the 19th century, and now their legacies are being reevaluated. Joining us now via Zoom is WCPO reporter Whitney Miller. Whitney, welcome back to our program.
Thank you so much.
We're going through this national reckoning on race, and we are reevaluating our own lives in a lot of respects, our own organizations, and also a lot of people that were glorified for their contributions to our community as we start to contextualize that and pay more attention to some of the atrocities that they were involved in. And two of our premier universities have such connections. So what did you talk about this week in your reporting?
Yeah, I talked about racism that is kind of hidden in plain sight, some monuments and structures around the area that have ties to slavery. And at Xavier and at the University of Cincinnati, at Xavier, there's a dorm, campus dorm named after Bishop Fenwick. And the University of Cincinnati, there is the College of Arts and Sciences that has Charles McMicken's name on it. So those are two of the visible buildings and structures on campus that have those ties. Both universities have been dealing with what to do with the names that are attached to their university. Xavier University has a group formed that's talking about name changes, and UC has not decided to take the name off of any of the structures or buildings. Instead, they have placed digital displays that kind of put McMicken and his history into context. But I've done some reporting where there are students who call for the name to come off of the Colleges of Arts and Sciences, who want them to even go further and take the name like off of the building. But we haven't been able to get in touch with anyone at the university to see if they're going to go further with that.
His name is all over the place. Charles McMicken's and you know,
there's street names after him as well.
Exactly. So in a lot of ways, it's probably safe to assume that there wouldn't be a University of Cincinnati, at least not the one that we know, without him. However, he is someone who owned slaves and wanted this university to exclusively educate white students. And yet there are all these buildings and locations, McMicken Hall, you know, McMicken Circle, McMicken Commons, the Mick and Mac statues and restaurant are not going to change, apparently.
No. So late last year, the university, they had like the Board of Trustees had a think tank, a panel about it. And the decision that they made was just to remove his name from the College of Arts and Sciences, so it doesn't appear on letterhead or on your diploma if you graduate in that college. But they didn't talk about what would happen on structures. And some of the students that we spoke with, former students, you know, said for them, you know, students shouldn't have to walk into a building and see that name and know that it has a negative connotation to their history.
When we talk about Bishop Fenwick at Xavier, we're talking about a local religious leader. What can you tell us about him that people may not know when you just hear his name generically referenced?
Yeah, he is the city's first bishop and founder of Xavier University. He did own slaves, and that was something that the university, it seemed like they have done some research and kind of a new discovery on their part. And so because of that, that's why Dr. Shahid, her name is Kyra Shahid. She created this. She's the director of the Center of Diversity and Inclusion at Xavier. But she also just started this project called the Stained Glass Initiative. So they are working to kind of figure out how to heal from that. The whole university is having these conversations with students and faculty just about what do we do and what does a name change look like? Because what I got from them is that it's not just about changing the name. They want to figure out, well, what do we do in this building going forward? And how do we honor the history, even with this stain that they have in their history?
Has there been any pushback more recently about these more recent discussions?
So every time I post a story about something like this, there are a lot of comments on social media about people who say, if you take these names down, you take the statues down, then you are kind of like denying the history of the university and where the school comes from. Dr. Shahid, though, she says that it is to leave the name on is a wound. And it's something that should be addressed and healed from. And she doesn't believe in leaving these names and these monuments up because they, you know, she calls them a visual representation of white supremacy. So there's always pushback, though, when people are talking about taking down something that is of history.
And again, we're talking with Whitney Miller, a reporter at WCPO. Whitney, your reporting this week also included an examination of the Black Brigade of Cincinnati and the Siege of Cincinnati in 1862 during the Civil War is a fascinating tale. But this part of that story is often overlooked. There is a monument honoring some Black troops who were integral in protecting the Queen City as Confederates were making advances through Kentucky. Tell us what you learned this week.
So this is interesting. I didn't know anything about this, but the Black Brigade of Cincinnati is started. So in the Banks area, it was called Little Africa. And that was where a lot of the African-American community lived. And there were talks in 1862 between amongst Black men trying to decide how can they help with defending the city from the Confederates. And they were told by the mayor at that time that they shouldn't, this doesn't concern you. You don't need to participate. But then a couple days later, the mayor by force had people come and put these men at gunpoint and gathered up 300 Black men to help fortify areas around the city to protect it. So then a Union general came and said, you know, you should let these men choose if they want to be here or not. You shouldn't have forced them to come. And so they went home. And then the next day, those 300 men came back with 400 more men. So it was 700, around 700 total that came back. And the point of that story, I guess, is that, you know, they were willing to help all along. But because of their race, there was an issue with them helping. And then why did you have to use force is what I talked to Stephen Miller from the Freedom Center. And he, you know, he was talking about just the point is why did the people at that time feel like they needed to force Black people to help protect, you know, their home?
It's so interesting that they forced those 300 men. And mm-hmm. then when it was suggested that they should be able to do so voluntarily, they did go home and then came back with more than twice their number.
Yeah, I mean, because at the end of the day, they too have families and people to protect as well. So, you know, I think it comes down to, you know, you have to forget about skin color when you want to protect, when everybody wants to protect their families.
A lot of fascinating and sometimes troubling history in the Cincinnati area, particularly as it relates to the Civil War. Whitney Miller is a reporter from WCPO. Thank you so much for your reporting, and thank you so much for spending some time on this Friday talking to us about it. We appreciate it, Whitney. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Halloween is approaching at the end of the month, but many of us have been wearing masks for months now. So what are we supposed to do on Halloween this year, especially as it involves our kids? Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Terry DeMio is with us via Zoom. Terry, thank you so much for spending Friday with us.
Thank you, Michael. I'm glad to do so.
Well, we're going to talk a little bit about this Q&A you had with some experts about how families should approach Halloween this year. But there are a couple of other pandemic-related stories that you produced this week, including $250,000 going to help domestic violence survivors. We've done some programs on this show about the spike in domestic violence during the pandemic as maybe troubled couples and vulnerable spouses spend more time at home with each other. What's new with this week?
Well, Women Helping Women, which is the local agency or maybe regional agency, I guess I should say, that is a nonprofit that helps survivors of domestic violence, had a shortcoming in its fundraising. But in addition to that, the agency has seen a 53% increase in its hotline calls. It was a 16-week period that included the shutdown, and it's not getting better. So Councilman Greg Landsman, I guess, was the person who proposed helping to fund a program that Women Helping Women does with the Cincinnati Police Department called DVERT.
And we're talking about more than just physical abuse. You reported that, I mean, earlier in September, the city reached a new high in murders of women. By September 9th, more women had been killed in the city than in any other year since at least 2000.
Yeah, it's been a terrible year for homicide, and particularly for women. You know, it is far from determined how many of those at this point were domestic violence related, but we do know because reporter Cam Knight, who's been covering Cincinnati police for a long time now, had done a review that shows that most of the violence against women, most of those deaths typically involve domestic violence.
And so Women Helping Women had some trouble raising money this year, about $250,000 shy of what they had hoped to achieve. And they were citing the pandemic. And yet, of course, as you noted, its caseload was going up. So do they feel like they've got enough to fulfill all of the obligations that they now find themselves with?
I don't think so. I think that they do feel much more comfortable. There have been other funding cuts, and it's just kind of precarious. I'm sure they feel better. I know that their president, Kristen Shrimplin, was very grateful to receive the support of the city, which has never before, according to Councilman Lansman, funded this particular organization.
We're talking with Terry DeMio, a reporter from the Cincinnati Inquirer. In addition to that, we're talking about pandemic-related stress and other pressures that we adults might feel and how that spills over into kids.
Yeah, that's right. We've seen across the country, and I know you're aware of all of this, as well as in Hamilton County, kind of an awkward drop in calls for suspicion of neglect or abuse of children. And yet the issue is that there are probably more children suffering from this because you now have kids that are fairly well isolated from adults they've typically had more contact with in school. You have people just not going to the doctor or doing it via, you know, telehealth. And that deprives children and really experts, doctors, nurses, the ability to confide. And so there's certainly a great concern that there are more kids being harmed, and in part because the economy is so poor, people have lost jobs, people are struggling with working and staying at home and watching their kids and helping them do school, et cetera. So it goes.
And so Safe and Sound at Home Cincinnati is the campaign that's been launched by Cincinnati Children's Hospital, Hamilton County Job and Family Services, and Cincinnati Public Schools. One of the messages that has come from this so far is just telling parents and other adult caregivers to, quote, take a deep breath when you get overwhelmed. So that sounds rather simple, but again, we live in very unsimple times. So what else does the campaign have planned?
Well, they're really trying to get awareness out about the fact that many of us are under incredible stress. And that message may seem a little simple because who thinks that they would neglect their child who normally doesn't do such thing. But I think it's because it acknowledges that there is stress out there and there are avenues for help. And that is the next part of the campaign, where on social media and with broadcasting services and so forth, they're getting out help for resources, both for children and adults, and for things such as food and maybe utility costs, or, you know, ways that people can alleviate their own stress so that it isn't, you know, falling onto children. And they, again, of course, are promoting that that call number that keeps kids safe and encouraging people, you know, these allegations, these suspicions are all checked out. So if you have any concern that you're seeing something that just might not be right with a neighbor, a relative, a friend, child, just call the hotline.
And that hotline number is 513-241-5437, 513-241-5437. We're talking with Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Terry DeMio. Something that kids do look forward to every fall is Halloween. You get to get dressed up. You get to walk around neighbors' houses and get candy. It's like everything that we're not supposed to do during a pandemic, getting too close to people and touching and all that sort of thing. And so you talk to some experts. So before we dive in to the advice that they're offering us in the community, talk a little bit about the types of people that you spoke to get perspective.
Right. So I've been going to a variety of people who have direct connections to, you know, are at the forefront of treatment and or research of COVID-19. So these are infectious diseases doctors or people who have been, who have, like maybe a cardiologist who is close to patients and have interacted with patients with COVID-19. And I've included pediatric experts in infectious diseases for some of these columns that I'm doing. And what I'm trying to do is say, listen, nobody wants to be told to eat their vegetables. What would you do? How would you do this? And how would you do it? So they can kind of come from a perspective of, well, I'm a parent. I'm trying to find parents for these, those types of things. Or I'm a doctor, but I'm just this regular person. How am I going to deal with this? So it's personal to them, but it's also with their base of knowledge and expertise.
So you ask them a very simple question. Would you hand out candy to trick-or-treaters? And I think we should note that it appears most municipalities I've seen have gone ahead and established their regular Halloween hours. The Commonwealth of Kentucky just yesterday issued some guidance. They didn't say not to have Halloween. So there were some different answers from these four experts that you spoke with, Terry. One said that they go back and forth on it. One says it's okay to hand out candy. One says as long as they're wearing a mask. And a fourth one says I would hand the candy to them, not allow them to stick their hand in the basket. So even on this issue, in a year of inconsistent messaging, it's still not exactly clear on what we should expect when it comes to actually acquiring the candy on October 31st.
That's true. And I found this to be true with doctors, just like you might with people or with these researchers and experts. I think the bottom line message for them is the messages we're all getting repeatedly, which is mask up, cover that nose and mouth. Keep your distance. Wash your hands before and after and any stops you, you know, anytime you go home to maybe drop off some candy. I think the ideas that each of them have kind of fall into those areas still. Like, for example, I wouldn't have a kid reach into a bowl, but I would drop it into their bag. And yet we also had, we had at least one of them say, I might leave a bowl at the end of my, you know, walkway for them. So you do have some inconsistency.
And my goodness, I guess people would at least be touching doorbells or knocking on doors. And when you have a number of kids coming to the door, you're increasing your contacts, which is something we're not supposed to be doing. And it just all seems rather overwhelming and complicated. But let's talk about masks a little bit, because you did ask. I mean, Halloween, particularly kids, like to wear masks as part of their costumes. We're being encouraged to wear facial coverings anyway because of the COVID-19 spread. So it seems these experts do agree that regardless of what kind of mask you're wearing as a costume, you should maintain the regular COVID-19 facial covering.
All but one. One doctor, and I think that was Dr. Frank from Children's Hospital Medical Center, who's an infectious disease expert, said that if the child's costume already covers both nose and mouth, he's not concerned about them wearing a mask under it. The droplets are what is spreading the virus. We know a lot more about that than we did before. And so a typical mask covering, he thinks, is enough. They aren't such tiny particles that they would get through that any better than a cloth mask.
And again, we're talking with Terry DeMio, a reporter at the Cincinnati Inquirer. A question about whether the candy that's collected by kids on Halloween should be washed. And again, inconsistent messaging from these experts.
That's true. Three out of four, maybe? No, I can't remember
half
exactly.
Half of them. Two said, yeah, wipe it down. Another one said, no, it doesn't live long on surfaces.
Right. We're learning more and more about COVID-19. Some of these infectious diseases experts are taking a more conservative view. Some are being are not. So it is pretty well established now that the virus does not live on surfaces for very long at all. Maybe a matter of an hour or two, maybe 1 to 3 hours. And those are just from my recollection. So there are a couple of these doctors who say, you know, they shouldn't be eating it on their way to and from. But yeah, it's okay. It's okay not to wipe it down. I do not have a young child. I feel like with the everything that I've gathered, I've been writing about this, I would do it. I mean, what's the harm?
Yeah, just one extra step of precaution. Hey, Terry, right. we've got someone who wants to share a comment. They've called in and we've got Libby on the line. Hi, Libby. What's your question or comment?
Hi, I was going to share the solution my husband and I have come up with that okay. We think is going to work for Halloween.
Well, sure, go ahead.
Or for trick-or-treating. So I found these tiny little bags, those little drawstring bags, just on one of the like bulk stores. But we'll put just 3 or 4 pieces of candy in one. We're going to do it the night before with my daughter. She's 7 because she'll be excited. But we were going to line those up on the end of the driveway, like space them out some. And then we usually sit in the driveway anyway just to monitor like, the neighborhood and stuff. So that I can watch and make sure you don't have the like 13-year-old who comes and swoops in and takes 5, but and then can kind of restock it. But so then they're still getting the candy. They can each take one. They're not reaching in a bowl. I'm not passing around in a bowl. But to still get the fun, but without being close to each other.
Well, that's very clever, Libby. It's kind of individually packaged little candy bags. What kind of candy are you handing out?
Oh, all the best. We'll find out. We'll see. We still have to buy it.
All right, Libby. Thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. I was wondering why they didn't suggest that, the experts you talked to, Terry, that you could just get some small bags. I know that might be wasteful and maybe a little more expensive, but to sort of just throw a few Tootsie Rolls or whatever into the bags and line those out.
That's a good question, and it's a good solution, I would think. Yeah, and these folks have time to come up with their answers. I'm not like putting them on the spot because I think what we want is a well thought out answer.
One last thing before we let you run, Terry, you know, there's not a lot in the way of Halloween parties for people our age this year. I mean, adults events are pretty well canceled, but what do the doctors have to say about whether kids should go to a Halloween party organized for them?
Almost unanimously, no, with a few different ideas. For example, stay within your family. Maybe if it's something where there's a bonfire outside somewhere and there are 6 to 10 individuals there, probably no more than 6 children, with masks and the ability to be, like I said, outdoors and distancing. But the traditional kind of Halloween parties that I think of when I see children, and I believe that, you know, what they're talking about is no, don't host nor send your child to an indoor crowded Halloween party.
All right, Terry DeMeo, thank you so much for the time. I guess we won't see you in a fun costume this year, but we hope to see you again soon anyway. Thanks for being with us.
It's been great to be with you, Michael.
Likewise. And thanks to all you listeners for all the contributions you gave us during our fun drive. We are so appreciative of that, and we're so glad you spent part of your Friday with us here at Cincinnati Edition. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Our technical director is Josh Elstrow. And I'm Michael Monks. Have a great weekend. We'll talk again on Monday.